You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Ontario Provincial Police have arrested and charged the former Thunder Bay Police Chief.
Thunder Bay's police chief admitted today that last week's criminal charges against his predecessor have led to what he called an erosion of public trust.
Police corruption in Thunder Bay, Ontario, was once a dirty local secret. But now it is the national news story that just won't end. 6 years ago, we and other reporters threw a spotlight on a wild situation. The mayor of Thunder Bay was facing criminal charges. His police chief was facing criminal charges. And the police service itself was under investigation by the province for systemic racism and for failure to properly investigate the many unexplained deaths of Indigenous youths. Well, that mayor got off the hook and that police chief was exonerated. The Thunder Bay Police Service was not so lucky. It was found to have botched those investigations, and its oversight board was torn apart. A new police chief was installed, a woman named Sylvie Hoff, and a new chairperson was put in charge of the police board. But that was not the end of it. News broke that Sylvie Hoff, now the former police chief of Thunder Bay, was arrested after being charged with a series of criminal offenses. But none of the reports explained much about just what the hell was happening this time. And I gotta tell you, I reported from Thunder Bay. I have edited or published 3 seasons of our Thunder Bay podcast. I worked with our team on our Thunder Bay TV series. And I have no idea what is currently happening. Most of this story is still unknown. But my colleagues, Ryan McMahon, John Thompson, and Karen Pugliese have been on this relentlessly. And in a moment, they will tell you what they can, what they have verified so far, and they will give you their best sense, let's call it a theory, of what the big picture story is here.
Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Karen.
Hey, John.
Hey, Karen. It's good to be back.
We're back here again. I guess there's more turmoil at the Thunder Bay Police Force. I mean, you guys have been through this. There's been external investigations into members, leaders in the service. There's been a whack of human rights complaints against senior officials and also the service's oversight board. There have been Indigenous leaders calling for the police force there to be disbanded. A little over a week ago, we have the arrest of a former police chief. What's going on? Give me a cast of characters.
Well, Karen, there's 3 of them. There's Staff Sergeant Michael Dimony, former police service lawyer Holly Walburn, and former police chief of the Thunder Bay Police Service, Sylvie Hoth. These 3 individuals all face criminal charges, and they are, if there is such a thing, the stars of today's show.
Wow. Where do we start?
Well, let's start with Sylvie Hoth. Former police chief Sylvie Hoth was supposed to be the big change. When Ontario took over the board with an administrator in 2018, you remember that's when the Thunder Bay Police Service was deemed systemically racist.
I remember that. I remember that very well.
The old board's last act was to appoint Sylvie Hoth chief permanently. So she rose quickly from her role as a community officer. She became deputy chief, and she was supposed to be making the big change once Thunder Bay hit these national headlines. Things clearly didn't go that way, and now she's under arrest.
So she's charged with what?
Hoth is facing 2 charges of obstruction of justice, 1 charge of obstructing a public officer, and a charge of breach of trust by a public official.
Okay, and there were 3 characters. Who are we going to talk about next?
Well, the next is the police service's former lawyer, Holly Walburn. She's facing very similar charges. 3 charges of obstruction of justice, 1 charge of obstructing a public officer, and a charge of breach of trust by a public official.
And finally, there was another police officer?
Staff Sergeant Mike Dimony. OPP has arrested Mike Dimony and charged him with obstruction of justice, breach of trust, and two counts of assault.
You're going to have to help me understand where this all starts. Out of these three people, who do we start with?
Yeah, well, let's start with Staff Sergeant Michael Dimony. I would say Dimony is a cop with the Thunder Bay Police Service that, by all accounts, was a rising star in the service. In 2018, he's nominated for a Police Service Hero of the Year award after pulling someone out of the river. I mean, I would say that if you Googled stereotypical image of a police officer, you might see Dimony's headshot. Like, he's chiseled out of stone, and he's the kind of cop they paraded him out when the Thunder Bay Police Service rolled out their police body cam initiative. And again, when you talk to anyone inside of the service, this is what they would say. He was a rising star. But behind the scenes, amongst the rank and file, many people that I spoke with had serious questions about the ethics of Dimony.
What do you mean, questions about his ethics?
Yeah, I had the same question, and it wasn't clear to me what they meant until we acquired the documents that outlined the Human Rights Tribunal complaints of a number of officers. And one of the particular documents we have outlines an evening on November 24th, 2020, when a call comes into the Thunder Bay Police Service that calls for officers to attend a scene in the south part of the city in an apartment block where a person says that there is someone in possession of a stolen television and they are watching them walk up the stairs of this apartment building with the TV. Kelly Walsh tells us that he is the first officer to arrive, and when he arrives, he sees Michael Dimony's father-in-law standing outside of the apartment building. And the father-in-law says, "My TV was just stolen out of my garage."
Wait, you're saying Michael Dimony, the cop. So this is his father-in-law?
His father-in-law is standing outside the apartment, pointing at the person that allegedly took the TV out of his garage. So Walsh calls for backup and another squad car comes. So now there's four officers on the scene and they decide to go in, knock on the door because they know the apartment. They know the person and they just want to get the TV back at this point. And that's what they do. Walsh walks up. He gets the TV without incident, explains to the person that this TV was reported stolen and the TV is returned.
But somehow it's wrong. I'm taking it. This is where you're leading me, right?
According to the Human Rights Tribunal complaints that we are in receipt of, Dimony arrives, runs up the stairs, and starts to berate the tenant who has just returned the TV. In these files, you'll read that all of the officers in attendance believe the call is over. The TV's been returned. But from there, everything escalates. Dimony then crashes into the apartment, and he starts swearing and yelling. And from there, in the documents, we read that it is utter chaos. One officer writes that he's not sure whether or not guns are going to be pulled or knives are going to be pulled.
Holy shit.
It's just utter chaos. And after the dust settles, everyone catches their breath, according to the documents. And it's at this time where Dimony points to the corner of a couch, picks it up, moves it, and finds a bag of drugs. Inside the documents, according to the officers in attendance, they are all shocked and dismayed for a number of reasons. They're not supposed to be in there. They do not have a search warrant. There was no reason for them to enter the apartment. And while in the apartment, now they've found drugs, there have been fights, all of these problems pile up for the cops and they know they are in trouble.
Okay, so I've just got to back up here. So this starts out with this cop's father-in-law having a TV stolen. It all gets settled. The TV gets returned. But he shows up, breaks the house, chaos ensues, drugs are found. Like, this just sounds crazy. Now, you're getting all of this out of these documents. These are from the human rights complaint, right?
That's right.
So the complaint has been made, but has it been heard yet? Like, has any of this been proven?
It has not been proven. There is quite a backlog, I am told, at the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario. And the officers that have filed these complaints are waiting for their day to tell this story. We do have the documents, and we do know that according to these officers, once they returned to the police station, that there was trouble afoot. They all had to file incident reports as to what happened, and all four officers were, in their own words, shell-shocked at what they had just witnessed, what they had just participated in.
So none of that's looking very good for Dimini.
No, it's not looking very good. I want to point out a couple of quick things, though, at this point, upon publishing this story. There are a number of Human Rights Tribunal complaints pending, now more than 25 complaints in front of the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario regarding Thunder Bay Police. And these hearings will happen sometime in the future. And I say that because officers inside of the Thunder Bay Police Service just feel like they hit dead end after dead end when they bring information over to their superiors. And this is the case with the story of Michael Dimini. Nobody seemed to care to listen. And that is what is inside of these particular complaints.
So is that everything about Dimini?
Well, Karen, there's a second story about Staff Sergeant Mike Dimini that happens at roughly the same time. There's an Indigenous board member named Georgianne Morisseau.
I remember Georgianne.
Right. You'll remember she was the former chief of Fort William First Nation, which is adjacent to Thunder Bay. She is at this point chosen as an Indigenous member as the board is trying to restore trust with the Indigenous community.
That's the Thunder Bay Police Services Board, right? She's the civilian board member, right?
Right. So she's out shopping at HomeSense, and somebody claiming to be an officer approaches her with this tip about a phone.
Oh, wait, a tip about a phone? What do you mean?
The tip is there's a leak happening at the police station out to a Facebook group that is exposing information that only internal officers would know about.
Can you just tell me what is being leaked and what is this Facebook page?
So, Karen, we're talking about the Inside Edition Thunder Bay Courthouse page, and this is frequently degrading descriptions of people who are facing bail court and often described as racist and classist.
Okay, so basically this is a public Facebook page that has insider information about cases, prosecutions, that kind of thing, and it's being leaked.
Crime and gossip and very gruesome descriptions of incidents and those who are alleged to have committed crimes. And the rumor that Morisseau heard from this person identifying themselves as a police officer was that a phone that was receiving this message from the proprietor of the Facebook page formerly belonged to Mike Dimini. But when Georgianne Morisseau takes this rumor about this phone to the senior police administration, they tell her a story that Dimini is actually part of an investigation into this. Rather than investigating Dimini for the leak, Police Chief Hoth and her deputy Ryan Hughes then started an investigation into board member Georgianne Morisseau. And this is where Hoth really comes on the radar that she may not be telling the truth. She was telling her board, quote, it would not be appropriate for a police service to investigate any of its members or board members.
So while she was investigating Morisseau.
This is really where the story that is going to be about this trial begins. Because we have these officers and the story that Ryan was telling about the stolen TV. And now we have a board member who have had issues with management that they can't bring to the leadership and have them address it that all have to do with Mike Dimini.
All this seems to be revolving around Mike Dimini.
Well, yes and no. You'll remember our third character, former Thunder Bay Police Service lawyer Holly Walburn. I have to tell you that Holly Walburn and Michael Dimini were a couple at this time.
Wait, how do we know that?
Well, it's in the HRTO, the Human Rights Tribunal filings. It was pretty much an open secret amongst the rank and file inside of the Thunder Bay Police Service. I'll remind you that in the making of the TV series, I did talk to close to 40 police officers, and this came up time and time and time again. And I hate to say it, but it's Thunder Bay. Everyone kind of knew that's what was happening.
Okay, so you just told me Holly Walburn is in a relationship with Dimini, and she's also being charged. What's going on?
Walburn is charged with three charges of obstruction of justice, one charge of obstructing a public officer, and a charge of breach of trust by a public official.
Okay, so do we know what she actually did?
No evidence has yet been submitted in a court. But it looks as though she may have lied to these oversight organizations that were doing these investigations. Again, as the romantic interest of Mike Dimony and the employee of Police Chief Sylvie Hoth.
Okay, so that's the allegation.
And the timelines line up for the stories that we've told you today that lead into this investigation.
This kind of brings you guys back to where you all started. You started out taking a look at the police force in Thunder Bay because of what was going on with unsolved deaths, an uninvestigated death by the police department of Indigenous people. So how is the Indigenous community reacting to all of this?
Well, as of the time of this recording, we see that NAN, Anishinaabe Aski Nation, which is the political organization that is based out of Thunder Bay, they have called a press conference for today, Monday morning, where they will be calling for the disbandment of the Thunder Bay Police Service.
Guys, this is just crazy. You know, you're coming in here, you're telling me all these things. It's an incredible, incredible story. It just sounds like this police force is falling apart.
Well, and the worst may not be here yet. I'll remind you that the OPP is saying officially that these investigations are ongoing. John, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but the OPP didn't come here to play around. I mean, when we were filming the TV series, we were told they had 6 weeks. They've been there over 2 years.
They didn't come here for 29 months to arrest three people for lying.
Mm.
That seems really unlikely.
So guys, thank you for coming in today and telling us everything that you're watching unfold in Thunder Bay.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
That's your Canada Land. I want you to know that submissions are open for something we've never done before, our first ever short form audio contest. If you want to join the industry of audio journalism podcasting, if you ever thought that it's something that you could do, if you already have a podcast, if you're trying to break in, if you're a hobbyist, we want your submissions. And we have crafted this in such a way that it's like fairly easy and fun and straightforward. We're looking for pieces that are 3 minutes long about local stories. And the point for us is to provide an open door, a way for people to get known to us and to everybody else. Everybody who applies for this is going to get listed on our website. So if you're an aspiring audio producer, you're going to have some search engine optimization. Your name is going to be associated with a podcast publisher. And if you win, we're going to publish your work. We're going to pay you some money. If you are a journalist, an audio producer, a filmmaker, an artist, a storyteller, whatever, this is a great opportunity to get your work in front of hundreds of thousands of listeners just like you. Our staff are forming a jury that's going to listen to this stuff. Canada Land people are going to listen to your work. We want to hear the stories you have to tell. So hit the link in the show notes to learn more or visit canadaland.com/audio contest. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Today's story was reported and presented by Ryan McMahon and John Thompson. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our production coordinator is Andre Proux. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called Syndications, handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Rahim Mohammed, freelance contributor with the National Post, joining us from Calgary. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me, Jesse.
Rahim, today on the show, smash that follow button, hit like and share. What it is like to follow a war through TikTok. And Bill Maher slams Canada. Also, Bill Maher still exists. Who knew? Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. So, Raheem, everything is totally fine now. The world's doing great, he said nervously. But there was a minute there on Saturday night where it kind of seemed like World War III had just popped off.
Israel is absolutely f***ed. Everybody sees this, right?
Big news, guys. Jordan and Saudi Arabia supported Israel last night.
If Iran and Israel go to war, this is who is predicted to win.
So you're telling me that Iran sent missiles over to Israel and it took 9 hours to get there, way longer than Amazon same-day delivery and shipping.
Hey, look, it's a picture of Tel Aviv before and after the Iranian bombing.
Raheem, I was trying to follow along at home. I, of course, started with mainstream news, was not getting a lot of information there. But when I was having trouble getting basic questions answered as to what was playing out and turned to social media, and then you got a taste of what that sounded like, it occurred to me as I was struggling to figure out what the f*** was happening, we are getting a taste of what it is going to be like to try to make sense of a major global conflagration in a post-news, low-information, high-deception environment. You write about this stuff. You've written about these attacks for the Post. You do opinion. That's totally okay. That's what we do here, too. But we do opinion based on other people's reporting. How did you find the experience of trying to just, like, follow the news as this was playing out?
Well, again, I kind of gave up on mainstream media. I feel like, you know, this day and age, you have deepfakes. You have artificial intelligence generated images, but you can mostly trust what you see, particularly when you're dealing with live footage. And for me, seeing projectiles explode one by one, being picked off one by one by the Iron Dome over the Dome of the Rock, that was quite a surreal sight. And it really brought home just how anomalous and just how exceptional the situation was. Again, you know, started with intuition and was able to ascertain through social media that the attacks were indeed ongoing through Saturday night and into Sunday morning, and sort of pieced together the best I could, you know, between my X feed, between reports from the CBC, CNN, other mainstream bodies, and tried to take it from there. But like you said, there was a let's call it a fog of war. Let's call it a digital fog of war that made things very difficult to piece together, at least initially.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you start off with CNN and you know, we talked about on the show before how we just don't have as many foreign correspondents. I don't necessarily want to wring my hands about that because I'm not sure that the foreign correspondents were telling us much. You know, by this point, it's kind of a cliched image of like the foreign correspondent on the like roof of their hotel in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and the sky is lit up with explosions. And they're like, well, there's a lot of explosions. And then I wonder, well, maybe everybody's got a smartphone, so maybe somebody has a better perspective on this. And, you know, we later find out just the extent of this. I mean, it is unprecedented for Iran to attack Israel from Iran and not from a proxy, be it Hezbollah or from Yemen. So we learn later that there are like 300 munitions, there are drones, there are ballistic missiles, there are these guided missiles, and you're seeing them overhead of Jerusalem. We later learn that, in fact, these ballistics were aimed at underpopulated military targets, and that the vast majority of them were intercepted, not just by Iron Dome. And I think a lot of the news value of what we learned is like, and what was unprecedented was like, oh, Israel had some help here. There were American fighter jets picking these off. There was Jordan and Saudi Arabia were lending support to Israel. And there was intelligence from the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and from France. And then on the other side of things, these missiles were not just coming from Iran, but were told by the Israeli military that some of the weapons launched at Israel were fired from Iraq and Yemen. All of this came to light afterwards. As it's happening, you're just wondering, like, okay, so are they, like, these are populated areas in a very small country. Is anything getting through? Mainstream media doesn't seem to know, so let's go to social media. And it's an interesting thing about the way AI works and the way that social media works is that, like, when you're looking for something, whether you're hoping to find it or not, there's an appetite to give it to you. And so if you're wondering, did any of these ballistics get through? Is there some, like, smoldering hellscape where missiles touch the earth? Well, that image was delivered to your eyeballs In fact, it was delivered by Iranian state news and then proliferated wildly on social media. But it was bullshit. It was actually footage from a Chilean wildfire of a, you know, blazing landscape and people stumbling around amongst fire and smoke, purporting to be, this is like people, Israelis under fire. And then you've got bad information circulating online to people like, oh, yeah, they got him. And other people, oh, hell no, they got us. And, you know, it just turns into, I saw tons of tweets like, yeah, Iran is attacking Israel. Hit like if you're on Iran's side, hit retweet if you're on Israel's side. And that's the quality of information we were largely receiving.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of a situation a few weeks ago in Haiti when we saw the unrest there, and the warlord in Haiti happened to be named Barbecue, which kind of lent itself to stories about cannibalism, roving cannibal gangs. And again, we saw a piece of footage that was total BS, that purported to show Haitian rebels, you know, dining on a human foot. It was taken from years ago. If you saw it, it didn't even look real. I mean, it looked like something out of a bad horror movie from the 1980s. So I think, unfortunately, with our information or disinformation environment, and I think the motivated reasoning a number of people on social media have, you're going to see those sorts of narratives take fire. You're going to see those sorts of deceptions potentially crack into mainstream reporting.
Yeah, and even where we were getting the debunking, there was the media picking up research done by a think tank, by the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. They're the ones who provided information later that let us know that in the early moments, there were like 30 fake videos and images that got over 35 million views in total. There were video clips that they were remixing through AI, some footage of Biden misreporting what, you know, basically just bullshit about what he's saying, all of which was inflaming, trying to suggest this is going further, this is going further. And it gets really mixed up into the real stuff. There were images of fighter planes that we were told were Iranian. They were actually from like an air show in Houston. A lot of it was kind of just like propaganda, almost like military heroics generated by AI to support people who were very excited about this attack. It was hard to figure out exactly what the hell was happening. And then the information that was getting reported, you know, I don't know how much of the misinformation got spread by mainstream news, examples of that, but in an information vacuum where you're not learning much from mainstream media, you go looking for, you know, what's happening on the ground, and that's where you find the fake stuff. The mainstream stuff, though, what did get through was state messaging. You had Iranian state messaging getting through on social media, this Chilean footage, but on mainstream media, of course, they're going to cover, you know, Netanyahu, who is saying, everybody, don't go to bed because we're going to retaliate. Which also turned out to not be true. I mean, you know, I would say thank God. But, you know, the role of mainstream media just sort of parroting what's being told through official channels and what they could see from their hotel rooftops, we were not getting a lot. I did ultimately get a greater sense of this after that hot minute when it looked like this might spread to World War III. Podcasts are great. And The Daily, and actually I was listening to Haaretz's podcast. What I learned from Haaretz is that it's been long spoken of and feared in Israel. Can Iran reach Israel? Now we know they can. And they very intentionally gave hours and hours of notice so that Israel and its allies could defeat this attack. And even so, they were careful not to aim this at densely populated urban areas because this is all performative stuff. This wasn't actually like a war, and they didn't want it to turn into one, it seems. And so when they say that there's 99% effectiveness, that still means that 1% got through. And if you've got 1% of 300 ballistics getting through, you've got three ballistics, if they had been aimed at Tel Aviv, well, Haaretz editor-in-chief Aluf Ben said, if one of those missiles hit Tel Aviv, we would be in a very different, devastating situation. Israel would feel forced to retaliate in a very different way and much sooner. And as if that happened three times. So this was aimed at underpopulated areas. And sadly, there was a casualty, a very serious injury of a 7-year-old Bedouin girl. But I don't know that this was a military failure on Iran's part. I think it was a demonstration of like what, look, if we could get a few missiles through your defenses in these underpopulated areas, think of what we could do if we sent 10 times as many ballistics to your populated areas. So like, let's just stop this now, I think was the message, at least what it was conveyed to me through Haaretz.
Sure, and I would say also it prompted Israel and Israel's allies in the region to show their hand. So in a way, it was kind of a fact-finding mission in that Israel sort of revealed and put its cards on the table in terms of, you know, the Iron Dome, its defense system. You know, you saw Jordan reveal its coordinated surface-to-air defenses as well. And Iran now has footage to study, you know, can now look at how the defense system was deployed. It could look for weaknesses, could look for ways to crack it. So I would also say Iran likely got a cache of valuable strategic information over the